Well, I've got an idea for a Mother's Day t-shirt. It came to me, and I'm like, I've got to actually go and see if I can print this somewhere. On the front of the t-shirt will be a mom, my wife probably, and she'll be holding a baby in one arm, and there'll be a screaming child next to her right here, and there'll be another two children on the side of the t-shirt fighting with each other, hitting each other, and one screaming at the other, and there'll be a dad in the corner here walking out of the door saying, "Happy Mother's Day!" That's my idea for a Mother's Day t-shirt. Because, you know, this morning, I'll tell you why. This morning, you know, it's Mother's Day, and my wife, just an amazing mom, our four crazy kids. And so we wake up a little earlier. Mom's in bed. We go downstairs. I get all the kids together, and we do the little cards, and we get the gifts all together, and we go upstairs to go and do the Mother's Day morning thing. And we walk in the room, and I go, "Okay, ready, guys? Sing!" And you hear Dad's voice, "Happy Mother's Day. Come on, Mother's Day, come on." And there's Hadley, my oldest, going, "Happy Mother's," and the other three are standing like this, you know. And then we come in, and you know, you hand her the cup of coffee, which she's like, "Oh, thank you, I need that." And then you give her the little presents and stuff, and there's stuff all over the place. And then I looked at her, and I said, "All right, I really have to go, I'm going to be late." And I grabbed a quick shower, and as I'm coming downstairs, she's coming down with all four of the kids to go and feed them breakfast. And I'm walking out the door to come here, and I see Brooke, you know, calling her one arm, right next to her. Cullen just hit Hope, and she's screaming, and Hadley's going, "I'm hungry, Mom!" And I looked back, and I thought, this is a t-shirt right here, as I went, "Happy Mother's Day, Brooke! Sorry about the, mess I'm leaving you with." You know, moms, it's just a whole different world, this whole mom thing, isn't it? I think about my mom and the things that my mom did. Have you ever had those thoughts about looking back at things that your mom did and you just go, "What was wrong with you? Why would you have done that?" And I'm talking about good things. Like, for instance, you ready for this? My mom ironed everything. She ironed everything in the house. I mean, she ironed my underwear. And I look back now, and you go to my mom and you say, "Mom, do you like ironing?" She doesn't go, "Oh, man. I mean, I wake up in the morning, first thought is, I hope I can iron today. I mean, no, I hate ironing." I'm like, well, why did you iron all of my clothes? I mean, my jeans were ironed. My underwear was ironed." And she goes, "Well, I just wanted to make sure when you walked out the door that you looked right and you looked good and everything was put together." I'm like, "Mom, no one sees my underwear." She's like, "I understand, but they're just, you know, I just feel like it just needs to be ironed, you know." And you just go, "Mom, really? Just put the iron down. Relax." Towels. How about towels? I mean, seriously, even saying this, I just want to laugh. I would take a shower growing up. I would use the towel and I would throw it in the laundry. And then my mom would wash the towel, you know, with all the other towels. And then the next morning, there'd be a nice fresh towel for me. I want to go to my mom now and go, "You know, you could have looked me in the eye and said, son, when you get out of the shower, you're clean. You dry yourself off, you hang the towel up, and I don't want to see it in the laundry for at least 2 weeks, and then I'll wash it." I'm like, "Mom, really? You could have done that." But you know, moms never do. I was reading quotes about moms, and I think my favorite of all the quotes I read this week about moms is this one right here. Mom is the person who, walking into the kitchen, sees four cookies and six people. I mean, sorry, that's wrong. Four cookies and five people. And immediately turns around and declares, "You know, I never really liked those cookies in the first place." And then hands a cookie to each one of the four except for herself. That captures the heart of a mom. Now, I know some of you guys, you had moms that were hurt or moms that had stuff in their lives and pain in their lives, and they weren't the greatest moms in the world. And I know there are exceptions to that. But generally, the heart of a mother, the heart of a mom is captured in that sense of this person who's constantly stepping aside to make sure that everybody else is successful. The story we're going to jump into today is right there in the Bible. I told God a while ago when we started this thing through the journey, I said to God, "Look, I just want you to understand, I'll journey from Genesis to Revelation, but there's some special Sundays going on, and we got to, you know, just want to be clear on those special Sundays. I may have to divert and do some other things and whatever," and God's, you know, obviously. But then every now and then God goes, "Oh, just, you know, you won't have to divert because I've already planned this out before the beginning of the universe." And so as I opened up to the story that we're going to read today, as I opened it up, it was just unbelievable how God just went, "This one's for Mother's Day right here." So I open up to the story right where we are in the book of 1 Samuel in chapter 18. Why don't you turn there while I give you a quick recap? If you don't have a Bible under the chairs, there's a bunch. Grab one of ours and turn to 1 Samuel in chapter 18, page 200 of our Bibles. Just to give you a quick recap, remember, we've just walked out of David and Goliath, right? I mean, when I say just walked out, I mean just walked out. He's actually walking off out of the battle into chapter 18. Chapter 17 ends when Saul was scared and the Israelites were scared. David comes on the scene. He defeats the great giant. And chapter 17 ends with Saul saying in verse 58, "Whose son are you, young man?" Saul asked him. David said, "I am the son of your servant Jesse of Bethlehem." I mean, do you see where we are in the story? Literally, David is bumping into Saul for the first time after he's defeated Goliath here, and Saul's about to sit down with him. And then chapter 18, verse 1 says, after David had finished talking with Saul. There it is. So chapter 18, verse 1 starts the same place chapter 17 just ended. David walks up to Saul. He goes, "I'm son of Jesse." Saul says, "Sit down, sit down, sit down." Okay, so tell me, I mean, seriously, do you have any idea what just happened? I mean, I sent you out and I could have sworn you'd be crushed by this guy, but you beat him. And with that little sling thing, I love it. You're awesome. Now, tell me all about it. Tell me, tell me, tell me. I want to hear. Can you imagine the conversation going on between Saul and David? I mean, Saul is ecstatic. The Philistines are destroyed. Goliath is dead. And this little runt kid is the one that did it. Saul wants to know all about it. So as they're talking about it, and David starts going, "All right, well," and you, can you imagine the questions? I mean, were you scared? I mean, I know you said you weren't scared, but be honest, weren't you scared? And David goes, "No, not really." And then as the conversation unfolds and David shares his heart, because we know David is fantastic at sharing his heart because we got the book of Psalms where he poured his heart out to us, right? So can you imagine what David must have communicated to Saul in that conversation? "Well, I mean, you know, just to recap on the lion and the bear thing, and I just knew God would. I mean, God's always been faithful to me, and he's never let me down, and I just trust him. I mean, I just trust God, and, you know, God is the, and no, it wasn't me, it was God who did." Can you imagine how that must have played out? In the wings, there's somebody listening into the conversation. And the person listening into the conversation's name is Jonathan. Jonathan is the son of Saul. He is the one slotted to be the next king of Israel. He is the prince that is going to become king. And he is listening to this conversation, and this is what the Bible says is his response. After David had finished talking with Saul, Jonathan became one in spirit with David, and he loved him as himself. It's a little verse that occurs right here in Scripture that we often breeze over. I mean, the relationship between Jonathan and David is certainly famous, but we breeze over it because we don't realize the incredible significance of what's going on here. But here Jonathan, suddenly, based on a conversation that David has with Saul, and you can imagine in that conversation what must have gone on, Jonathan sees David's heart and goes, "Man, this is the kind of guy I want to spend my time with." I wonder, as the conversation was unfolding, whether Jonathan didn't think back on all of the times that he's watched his father slowly descend from the heights that he was, where he trusted God and he believed in him and he lived by him, into where he is now, where he's arrogant and he's selfish and he's anxious and he's fearful. And then listening to David and going, this is how I want to be. I want to be like David, not like my dad. You can imagine as he comes to David and he says, "Oh man, that was awesome what I just heard. Whew, unbelievable." And they start talking and David shares his heart with Jonathan and they become one in spirit. Well, it turns out right there, it says in verse 2, "From that day Saul kept David with him and did not let him return to his father's house." Then in verse 3, it takes us a step further, "And Jonathan made a covenant with David because he loved him as himself. Jonathan took off the robe he was wearing and gave it to David, along with his tunic, and even his sword and his bow and his belt." What's going on here? Jonathan comes to David at some point in this developing friendship, and he says to David, "I would like to make a covenant with you." Listen, in these days, the covenants that were cut in these days were nothing like the covenants we make today. These were serious things. In fact, when you made a covenant with somebody, if you broke that covenant, death was one of the options. So when you made a covenant, you were serious about that covenant because you knew if you broke it, you could die. And so as David steps in and Jonathan comes, he says, I want to make covenant with you. I want to bind myself to you. He goes further than simply making covenant. He takes off his robe and he gives it and places it on David. We see that and we're like, oh, that's so cute and neat, but it's not cute and neat. It is incredibly, incredibly important. Because in these times, in these days, especially the prince, the crown prince, would have been wearing stuff that dictated him as crown prince. He would have walked around in a robe that said, this is the prince, kind of like what we do today. You know, we have our little things and stuff. And here he steps in and he takes the very authority that he holds, his status, his future, and he takes it off and he puts it on his friend David. And then he goes further than that. He takes off his tunic and his belt and his sword and his bow. A sword was something that you held by your side, and this time, all the time. You slept with that puppy right next to your bed because you never knew when someone was going to attack, and that was the only thing you had to protect yourself. Pull that sword out and be ready. And a bow was an incredible status symbol in this time. A bow would have been something that you had only if you were kind of in the elite warrior forces here. Not to mention, if you were the son of the king, you definitely have a bow. The bow was invented way back in Genghis Khan's time, and it's what gave Genghis Khan the ability to defeat the entire Asia as a continent, because he invented this weapon that you could stand a distance from a sword and fire and kill someone with. The bow was an incredible weapon to have, and it was a safety net for Jonathan and a status symbol, a symbol of power. And what does Jonathan do? He hands the sword over, he hands the bow over, he hands the tunic over, and then he takes his belt off, and he hands his belt. You kind of go, that's a little weird. Here, you can have my belt. But in these days, again, the belt was such a significant thing. In Ephesians chapter 6, when Paul speaks of the spiritual armor, he says, put on the what? The belt of truth. Why? Because it is what holds everything else together. You carry your sword on your belt. You hold your armor together with your belt. It keeps your clothes on so you don't look like a fool running around naked. The belt is important. And by taking his belt off and handing it to David, again, he is relinquishing all of his protection, all of what keeps him away. And he says to David, I'm all yours, man. You could literally kill me right now and I'd have no defense. My power, my prestige, my position, I give it to you, friend to friend. What an incredible moment in time that must have been happening here as Jonathan, by God's grace, starts realizing this is the man I want to align myself with. This is the man because I see God in him. Well, the story continues to unfold and some amazing things begin to happen. It turns out right here in chapter 18, it says in verse 5, when whatever Saul sent David, it's David, him to do, David did it so successfully that Saul gave him a high rank in the army. In chapter 18, verse 5, this pleased all the people and Saul's officers as well. Well, after returning from killing some more people in war, this is what happens. The woman, in verse 6, came out from all the towns of Israel to meet King Saul and singing and dancing with joyful songs and with tambourines and lutes. As they danced, they sang, you ready? Saul has slain his thousands and David his tens of thousands. It's time for a choir meeting. Immediately, back room, go. When we're in front of the king, we generally don't sing, King killed 1,000. His little army guy killed 10,000. Woo! Bad move. And you know what? The reality is it's especially a bad move when you're dealing with a king who is threatened by everything and anyone. See, Saul's gotten to the place in his life where his position is all about him. He's got to hold on to that kingship with all that he's got. And if you ever find yourself in a position in life where you are trying to hold on to your status and hold on to your position and hold on to your authority or hold on to the little things that you have, then anyone that comes into your life that threatens that is going to threaten you. And when they threaten you, you're going to turn evil on them. And you're going to do all sorts of things you'll regret later on. When we hold on to ourselves, it's not a good thing. And Saul, holding on to his position here, sees David as a threat. And immediately the Bible tells us he got angry and jealous and he kept a jealous eye on David. Well, as this unfolds, it turns out that Saul ends up figuring out how he's going to get rid of David. He's just going to kill him. That's the easiest solution. Get rid of David completely. He's no longer a threat. David finds out about this, and this tension starts developing, and David realizes the tension. And that is when Jonathan comes in a huge, huge way. In chapter 19, in verse 1, it says, Saul told his son Jonathan and all the attendants to kill David. But Jonathan was very fond of David and warned him, "My father Saul is looking for a chance to kill you. Be on your guard tomorrow morning. Go into hiding and stay there. I will go out and stand with my father in the field where you are. I'll speak to him about you and tell him, and I will tell you what I find out." See what Jonathan's doing here? Had Jonathan not stepped into the story right here, and had Jonathan not been loyal to David, if the covenant had just been a politically correct move, if the covenant had just been aligning with a powerful man, then this would have been Jonathan's perfect opportunity to step back and say, "Dad, you kill him, and we don't have to worry about him." But Jonathan steps in and warns David that he's going to die and puts him into hiding. Then he steps in between David and his dad and says, "Dad, what are you doing, man? I mean, what has David ever done to you? Oh, in fact, let me tell you what he's done for you. He's conquered armies for you. He's raised your position. All of Israel worship you as king again because David is helping you. Why would you want to kill him?" And Saul goes, "Yeah, you know, you're right. It's not the best move in the world to kill David at this current time. So I'm going to go ahead and make an oath." And here's the perfect example of a covenant made by a man whose heart is after God, Jonathan, and a covenant made by his father, Saul. Saul listened in verse 6, chapter 19. Saul listened to Jonathan and took his oath, and took this oath. "As surely as the Lord lives, David will not be put to death." Whatever. Yeah. So, verse 7. So Jonathan called David and told him the whole conversation. He brought him to Saul, and David was with Saul as before. And Jonathan's going, "This is awesome. Dad's friends with Saul. I got the thing fella." But in verse 9, "But an evil spirit from the Lord came upon Saul as he was sitting in his house with his spear in his hand while David was playing the harp. Saul tried to pin him to the wall with his spear, but David eluded him as Saul drove the spear into the wall. That night, David made good his escape." Oh, there's so much for an oath, right? First time David's sitting playing, Saul tries and spears him. So here we have Saul trying to kill David again. Jonathan finds out about this, and we see the relationship between David and Jonathan continue on. If you turn to chapter 20, we start right in the very beginning of chapter 20. David is fleeing at this point, and then he went to Jonathan in verse 1, and he said this in chapter 20, "What have I done? What is my crime? How have I wronged your father that he is trying to take my life?" "Never," Jonathan replied. "You are not going to die. Look, my father doesn't do anything, great or small, without confiding in me. Why would he hide this from me? It's not so." See what's happening here? Jonathan's going, "This is impossible, David. You're imagining things, man. My dad's not trying to kill you." David's like, "Jonathan, bro, this spear missed my head by a quarter of an inch when it hit that wall. Trust me when I tell you, your dad has a temper problem, and when he gets mad, he tries to kill me. And I'm not going to go and sit there and do that." But David took an oath and said, "Your father knows very well that I have found favor in your eyes, and he has said to himself, 'Jonathan must not know this or he will be grieved.'" See, dad's keeping Jonathan out of the mix now because Jonathan, dad knows this is one of Jonathan's best friends. I just don't want to make him sad. I'm going to kill David, make up some kind of story. Jonathan will be fine. "Yet as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, there is only one step between me and death." Jonathan said to David, "Whatever you want me to do, I'll do it for you." Listen, folks, you got to understand what's going on here. If this is true, and dad's trying to kill David, dad is only trying to kill David because David is a threat to what? To the throne, right? And who is supposed to be on the throne next? Jonathan is. So from a strategic perspective, this is not good business for Jonathan. Here he is gallivanting around with the one person that's threatening the throne that his dad is sitting on, that Jonathan is due to have next. But instead, what do we find Jonathan doing? He is constantly finding himself at David's side going, "I'll talk to dad. I'll get this squared away. Don't worry about it. You will not die." Do you see what's developing here? This is more than a mere covenant. This is more than a deal. This is a friendship that runs deep and a love for one another. And now you're beginning to see a man who is certainly has everything laid out before him to take the throne. And what he keeps doing is bringing another man up that seems to be a threat to the entire deal. And here you begin to see what true godliness begins to look like in relationship as God says, this is how I want you to treat one another. Well, it turns out that Jonathan goes back to dad and says, look, what's going on? How come you're trying to kill David? I don't understand. David said you're trying to kill him. Did you throw a spear at him? You know what happens? It's right there in the story. Saul gets mad at Jonathan. He pulls his spear out. He's got it in his hand, and he holds his spear up to Jonathan like he's going to kill him. And he says, look, you are aligning yourself with the wrong folks. You are in with the wrong crowd. And that man is a threat to this throne and your throne for that matter. And you are standing here and you're defying me. You will kill this man and you will not be aligned with him anymore, or I will kill you. It's basically how it plays out. So at that point, I think Jonathan went, all right, I think dad might be trying to kill David. So grieved, Jonathan goes out and he says to David, listen, man, it's time to go. There's no fixing this. I don't know what's going on with dad, but it's spiraling downhill fast. You go and you hide and you come back when things have settled down. See what Jonathan's doing again? When he's setting up David for success at the cost of his own life in times. He's standing before a man that would kill him for the sake of David. Well, the story continues to unfold in their relationship, and Jonathan just doesn't stop stepping aside for the sake of David. And then in 2 Samuel chapter 1, we find out that Saul and Jonathan die in battle together. It's a sad day. 2 Samuel, page 210, chapter 1, and it says in verse 17, David took up this lament concerning Paul and his son Jonathan, and ordered that the men of Judah be taught this lament of the bow. This is a song David wrote, if you will, for this at the funeral. And David writes this song, and this is what he says. Look at verse 23. We'll jump forward. Verse 23 says, Saul and Jonathan, in life they were loved and gracious, and in death they were not parted. They were swifter than eagles. They were stronger than lions. O daughters of Israel, weep for Saul, who clothed you in scarlet and finery, who adorned your garments with ornaments of gold. How the mighty have fallen in battle. Jonathan lays slain on your heights. I grieve for you, Jonathan, my brother. You were very dear to me. Your love for me was wonderful, more wonderful than that of a woman. How the mighty have fallen. The weapons of war have perished. I can't even begin to tell you how often those verses are taken out of context to create all sorts of wonderful agendas about all sorts of things, but I'll tell you what this is right here. This is the man David, in his beautiful way like he did in all the Psalms, laying out his deepest feelings, and he shares with us a secret here about relationship. See, there's nothing greater on this planet than the love between a man and a woman. As that relationship comes together and is consummated in marriage and you have this thing, and some of you are sitting here going, I don't know, marriage is kind of crazy, and I go, I know. But when you're without it, then you're single, and every single person I know, all they ever talk about is, well, no, when's God going to give me my spouse? And I go, I hear you, man. There's something about us innately that just knows there's a power in the relationship between a man and a woman that comes together, and there's something beautiful there. And Jonathan says, let me tell you something. That is the most powerful pinnacle of love on this planet, but there is something greater. When a human being comes alongside you and lifts you up at the cost of their own dreams and their own hopes and their own desires and their own rights, there is something about that kind of love, something about that kind of loyalty that is better than any other love on the planet. It is a beautiful kind of love when we come alongside and we do that. And when a man and a woman do that for each other, it takes a man and woman's love to a whole other ball game. But true, powerful, beautiful love is the sacrificial kind of love where one sets themselves aside for another. Jonathan treated me like a king, and he didn't even know I was a king. See, when Jonathan knew David, he was already anointed king by God. So as far as God was concerned, he was already king. And here Jonathan treated David like king. And because Jonathan did that, guess what happened to Jonathan? He got to live his life changing the entire planet. Because it turns out, because Jonathan was in the story, and because Jonathan kept warning David, he kept saving David's life, just as God had intended Jonathan to do. And as David's life was saved, David could emerge in his journey and become King David. And when he became King David, he ruled Israel. And out of King David came the line that was prophesied to bring the Messiah. And the Messiah came to this planet and became our Messiah and changed all of history by spilling his blood so that we wouldn't have to spill ours. And he became our Messiah. And because of all of that, the entire reconciliation process was brought together by God. And you know what happened? When Jesus was born on the planet and he died on the cross, I bet it was Jonathan sitting next to God going, "This is unbelievable." And God looked at Jonathan and said, "Man, I know." And you know what? Had you not stepped in to be part of David's story, things would have turned out very differently. That's why I had you there. That's why I made you one in spirit with David. That's the role you got to play. Yeah, you never got to be king, but you got to change the world forever. Because you allowed David to become who he needed to be so that I could allow my plans to unfold on this planet the way I needed them to unfold. Well done, Jonathan. Well done. I think of moms. And I think of our moms today, and I think, you know, a good mom, it's exactly what she keeps showing us, isn't it? She keeps stepping in and saying, "I got dreams. I got hopes. I got desires. I know my wife does. I know my wife's a driven person, and she's got all sorts of wonderful things she wants to do in this life. And you know what she does? Every day she stays home, and she has four kids climbing all over her, and she takes care of them, and she watches over them, and then every night she's working to get them to bed, and all the time she's dragging me and saying, "Now you got to be part of this," and reminding me that that's really important. And my wife spends herself on those children. Gives herself away. She never gets to live her dreams. Never gets to be the person she might have wanted to be. She gets to be a mom. And I'll tell you something, moms. Some days I know it's hard to live that life. I know it is. And we don't say it very often, but we want you to know that we know. We know what kind of a crazy life you live. We just don't say it much because we're scared. Because then when we say it a lot, we'll figure out how you really live this life, and then you'll be able to start going, "You're right. You're right. Good for you." We know how much laundry you do, especially if you wash your towels every day. But I want to tell you something else. Someday you'll find out that you've changed the world completely because you set yourself aside for the sake of those children to be successful. And just like my wife sits every day and goes, "These kids got to grow up, and they got to grow up well because then they'll change the world." I want you to know that you are changing the world every day. And when it gets tough and it gets hard and they're screaming at you and you're not grateful and your husband ain't saying anything and you got to take care of him as much as you got to take care of the kids and all that stuff's happening, you sit back and you go, "God, someday when I sit with you, you better tell me how I changed the world because it doesn't feel so good today." And God will whisper to your heart, "Mom, you're changing the world, I promise. My plans will unfold because of what you're doing because you're setting yourself aside." And for the rest of us in this room, that aren't either moms yet or that are men, let me tell you something. The call is clear. It's very clear. God does not just call moms to live that life. He calls all of us to live that life. He says to all of us, "I want you to set yourself aside for the sake of your king." Jonathan set himself aside for the sake of King David. We ought to set ourselves aside for the sake of King Jesus. And it is easy walking out there, and it is so easy getting out into that world and working your plans out to make sure that your life comes together, that your bank account is full, that your stuff is in place, that you are secure, that your prestige and your power is attained in business, and everything's working out well. It's very easy to do. We all do it on a regular basis. It's not as easy to sit back and say, "God, whatever the cost, here's my tunic, here's my sword, here's my bow, here's my belt. I'm kind of naked before you at this point. You could kill me, but I want you to know everything I do is about you." Because what did we find out in Scripture? There's nothing that is given to us that isn't given to us by God. I want to close with this thought. Turn with me to the New Testament, to the book of John real quick. In John chapter 3, there is this beautiful little story, and it'll just take me a minute to share this with you. John chapter 3, we're down in verse 26 of John chapter 3, page 738 of our Bible, 738, and here's what it says. John the Baptist is on the scene. His disciples come to him, and they say this. They said to John and said to him, "Rabbi, that man who was with you on the other side of the Jordan, the one you testified about, well, he's baptizing, and everyone is going to him." Do you hear it in their voices? "John, you're a great man. We love you. You're our leader. And you, this guy came, and you baptized him, and that's the one you spoke of, and now everyone's going to him. What are you going to do about it?" And John replies and says this. To this, John replied, "A man can receive only what is given him from heaven. You yourself can testify that I said, 'I am not the Christ, but I am sent ahead of him.' The bride belongs to the bridegroom. The friend who attends the bridegroom waits and listens for him and is full of joy when he hears the bridegroom's voice. That is my joy." Well, that joy is mine. "And it is now complete." And then he says this, "He must become greater. I must become less." Jonathan demonstrates to us what it means to become less for the sake of another. And he shows us how a story unfolds into greatness when we're willing to do that. John the Baptist shows us in word that we are to become less for the sake of Christ. As we give ourselves away for the sake of others, so in so doing we give ourselves away for the sake of Christ. And then our moms, every day, they live their lives before us. And they whisper to us through their actions, "This is how it's done. This is how it's done." May you be inspired by your mom today. May you be inspired by John the Baptist and by Jonathan. And may you and I become men and women that are willing to find ways to serve Christ as we give ourselves away for him. Then you'll walk into a story that will become one of the great ones in this world. Mothers, thank you for setting the pace for us. Keep up the good work. You're changing the world forever. Let's pray. God, we love you, and we thank you for this incredible story that you've given us, and we thank you for Jonathan and his willingness to set aside his rights, his dreams, his desires for the sake of David's. And God, I'm sure Jonathan is enjoying the ride now as he sees how it's all unfolding. Would you remind us all as we give ourselves away for the sake of our children, for the sake of our spouses, for the sake of our friends, for the sake of the business in which we work, for the sake of you and your church and your kingdom, as we spend ourselves by faith in ways that otherwise we wouldn't if we were thinking about ourselves, as we direct our talents and our gifts towards serving you in all the arenas that we're in, as we make decisions that may put our jobs or our lives or our whatever at risk for your sake, as Jonathan did for David's sake, would you whisper to us, "You're changing the world. You're changing the world." And may we do it as John did, with great joy, because we hear your voice knowing that you are our King. We thank you for our moms. We love you. Would you use this story in our lives to make us the men and women that you know we can be? We love you, Jesus. Amen.